Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Michael Feinstein has made a legendary career of shining a spotlight on some of our country's most important music. An accomplished pianist and singer, he's long championed the likes of the Gershwins. He got his start as Ira's assistant. Frank Sinatra, Irving Berlin, Hugh Martin, Burton Lane, Frank Lesser, Jerome Kern, Duke Ellington, and many others. He's also a composer and arranger of original material. Feinstein has sold millions of records and performed across the globe, earning 2 Emmy and 5 Grammy nominations. The founder of the Great American Songbook Initiative, Feinstein's television show of the same name is seen on PBS, and this fall he'll publish his latest book, The Gershwins and Me, A Personal History. Feinstein will join with the Boston Pops and Tony winners Christine Ebersole and Betty Buckley on Sunday, September 2nd at Tanglewood in Lenox, Massachusetts for the American Songbook. And it's a pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for the nice introduction.
Sure. So why do you feel so protective of the songbook?
It matters greatly to me, this material, these songs of Gershwin and Kern and Porter and Berlin and Ellington and Fats Waller and the like. They're songs that, to me, are to be treasured greatly. They're songs that need to be preserved, and they only exist if people perform them, if people sing them, if people listen to them, if people share them with others. And I feel that they are songs that have transcended the time in which they were written. They still have currency for today. They still have values and emotion and are pertinent.
What are some of the challenges of taking on that responsibility?
I think about the fact that sometimes somebody may be at a concert of mine and may be hearing these songs for the first time. They may not know anything about this music, and if I don't do the songs well, they're not going to like them. Like recently, I heard a well-known performer, a writer and a performer who is not known as a singer, put together a show that had a big band and was certainly well-prepared in a certain way, but his performance of the songs were not particularly great. And the thing that bothered me was that there were a lot of people who were fans of this guy who had never heard this music before, presumably, and I thought, oh, gee, they're going to leave thinking that the songs aren't very good. And that bothered me.
And when you are going back and picking up on a particular artist, how much freedom do you feel to reinterpret or rearrange?
I think that the songs survive because they are reinterpreted, and it's a matter of taste. So I can take great liberties, even though people tend to think that I'm a purist. I'm not a purist about certain things, about lyrics I am, and certain aspects, but they have to be living, breathing entities, and they survive because of the different interpretations, but it's always got to be tasteful.
The man who only lives for making money lives a life that isn't necessarily sunny. Likewise, the man who works for fame, there's no guarantee that time won't erase his name. The fact is, the only work that really brings enjoyment is the kind that is for girl and boy men. Fall in love, you won't regret it. That's the best work of all if you can get it. Holding hands at midnight, neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl.
How did you learn the piano? Were you playing classical music when you were so young, or was it the songbook that first got you started?
I started playing piano by ear when I was 5. I've never really had any proper formal training. A few lessons here and there. And growing up in Columbus, Ohio, I took piano lessons from a lady named Marjorie Cook, who taught me chord substitutions, but no classical training and no extensive training of any sort. And so it was organic. It was really an organic process for me where I started listening to the songs, listening to records, seeing them on TV and movies, and learning to play them on the piano.
Hmm. And then, of course, you famously went to L.A. You were 20 years old and hooked up with Ira Gershwin. Have you thought about where would you have gone if that meeting hadn't happened?
The period where when I met Ira Gershwin, I was 20 years old, and it was a pivotal time in I guess, anyone's life in that it's a crossroads, a time of crossroads. And I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. I probably would have played in piano bars or done something with music on whatever scale I could, because I got so much fulfillment, as I still do, out of performing the songs and sharing them with people. And so it would have been in some performance capacity, I imagine, unless I would have gotten burned out playing piano bars. And the other thing that interested me was cataloging and archiving, so I might have become a librarian.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure we're going to try to have you back on when the book comes out in October, but since we're talking about the Gershwins anyway, what was it about their music that so touched you?
The Gershwins have a special energy imbued into their work. There's something about the sound of George Gershwin's music that is so distinctive and so deeply resonant with so many people, and certainly with me. The first time I heard Rhapsody in Blue was a watershed moment in my life. I'd never had that kind of reaction to a piece of music, and it was almost like an addiction. And I feel this deep connection with Gershwin still, and there is an essence of Gershwin that I try and help preserve. And that energy, I guess that's the best way to describe it, is something that is so incredibly powerful today still. And so I have a great desire to share the history and the story of the lives of both the Gershwins, because it's an extraordinary story how, in George's case, this kid from Brooklyn, who was uneducated, became the greatest American composer of the 20th century, the greatest, the best-loved composer, American composer in the world. I mean, it's extraordinary. He died at the age of 38, and then his brother, who was a literary, writing lyrics and writing these perfect words for George's melodies. It's a fascinating story, and it's kind of a Horatio Alger story. It's a story of fulfilling one's dreams, of following one's vision and instinct and not letting ourselves be swayed by other things. I mean, it's so powerful that I think it still captivates people on that level as well as the music.
And, of course, you are a big part of that story looking forward to this century.
It's wonderful to be able to help perpetuate the work. I don't consider myself a major part of the Gershwin story. I think I'm just a footnote in the history of the Gershwin's work. However, I will do what I can to help sustain their work in whatever way I can.
Let's talk about the Pasadena Pops. We've just learned that you will become the lead conductor there, so congratulations are in order.
Thank you.
How come you wanted to take that job? Of course, it's a job that's unfortunately just opened up with the death of Marvin Hamlisch. And what are some of the challenges for you looking forward?
First of all, it was not a job that I dreamed about or wanted to take. I had done the last concert that Marvin ever gave, which was with the Pasadena Pops, where I met and worked with these wonderful people. Marvin was like a brother to me. I adored him and was beguiled by his talent. As I said to someone the other day, he made me feel more talented than I am. And I was contacted by the orchestra, blindsided by it, mind you, asking if I'd consider doing it, something I've never done, not conducting an orchestra. And it took some soul searching, but these circumstances made it feel like it might be okay, that it might be appropriate. And I really felt like it was a continuation of something that Marvin began that I could help perpetuate. And so it was these specific circumstances that gave me, as we say, the chutzpah to tackle it.
Had you two ever discussed you possibly succeeding him?
No. First of all, Marvin was somebody who everybody expected to live at least another 20 years. Marvin was this energizer bunny, so his passing was so shocking. And I never seriously considered conducting. I've considered a lot of things, but I was asked a few years ago if I'd be interested in conducting, and I said, no, I can't do that. But now I have a different perspective, and I'm guardedly excited about it.
In your experience, what makes a good conductor?
A good conductor is someone who can communicate the sense of the music to an orchestra. It has to be about the bigger picture of the music. In other words, any number of people can beat time. Any number of people can beat time for someone to do Beethoven's Fifth. Now, mind you, I'm going to do pops music, but these orchestras have played Beethoven's Fifth a million times. So what the conductor has to give the orchestra is the enthusiasm and the joy of that moment, because otherwise it's just another performance of Beethoven's Fifth.
And are there specific things you picked up on from Marvin Hamlisch that, you know, you'd like to emulate or build on?
One of the things that Marvin did was really engage the audience. He was a great conductor. He was wonderful in the way he was able to get the music that he wanted to share out of the orchestra, and he made it a collaboration, of course. The other element is that this is a performance with an audience where you have to communicate not only the music to the audience, but the context of how the music is set up, what is said before the numbers. Marvin was a master at introducing the music in a way that made it accessible. He had humor. He had an ability to galvanize an audience and make them hear a piece of music differently after he spoke about it. And so that's an essential element. It is show business, and so it's theatricality. And so that's the other element of it that he made me keenly aware of.
Following up on that, you've been enmeshed in this Sinatra project over the last several years, and I wonder, is there anything to be picked up on when you go into an artist catalog on the performance side? Because we think of Sinatra almost as much as a character and of course, his famous movie acting and a stage presence as we do a musician.
Well, Sinatra to me was the total artist. He was not just a singer, but it was the approach he had to the totality of his art that made it so special. He was involved in the orchestration in that if he got into the studio and didn't like something, he would change it. The sound, the miking techniques, the production afterwards. He was very hands-on, as opposed to other singers who would sometimes go in, they'd read the lead sheet, they'd sing the song, and they'd leave. They'd basically do what the producer told them to do. And so I wanted to capture, or emulate, rather, his taste and his style, his overall approach to the music and in a certain way to life, at least the favorable parts of his character, which contrast greatly to the other. And so for me, I wanted to imbue my tributes to Sinatra with my last two CDs called The Sinatra Project with that sense of his overall style and taste, because I knew that I couldn't sing the songs better than he did, and there was no point to try and copy him. So I tried to distill what it was about Sinatra that made him special and give that a different perspective for a contemporary audience.
So what is that process actually like? Do you hear Sinatra and in your mind imagine what you can do with that song or what you'd like to do, or does it involve sitting down and trying a bunch of things out first?
Sometimes I'll hear a Sinatra interpretation and think, oh, I would do the verse, which he didn't do, or there's extra lyrics, or I would slow down the tempo, or I would like to try this kind of approach. Other times, I have to live with a recording or a song, and it has to gestate, it has to grow, and it has to evolve in the way that it is going to end up being in my interpretation. I can't approach anything as an interpreter unless I feel I have something to say about it that is unique to me. And so in this case, I knew this was a special challenge because Sinatra is a golden name, iconic name, and it's tough to approach what he does and try and reinvent it.
Doesn't like crap games with barons and earls. Won't go to Harlem in ermine and pearls. Won't dish the dirt with the rest of the girls. That's why the lady is a tramp. She likes the free, fresh wind in her hair. Life without care. She's broke, it's oak. Hates California,
it's cold and it's damp. That's why the lady is a tramp.
The greatest gratification for me was after I'd done a few shows for the first time of a Sinatra homage. His fans, there were a lot of diehard fans of Sinatra's there. They gave me their approval by their response, and that gave me the confidence to move forward, because those were the people who I knew would be the hardest critics.
Were you very fond of Sinatra?
He was great to me, and I was fond of him. I wasn't fond of everything about him, but the parts of him that I saw were wonderful. There are many stories about him and things that happened to people I know that weren't very nice in connection with him. But I understand now that he was someone who was, in today's parlance, bipolar. He had a lot of demons, and he had a lot of things that got in the way of his own happiness, and that's the tragedy of his life. And so I choose to focus on the marvelous aspects of what he gave to all of us, and also the fact that he was very kind to me when I was just starting out.
Michael Feinstein, what do you have in store for Tanglewood? I know you're going to be paired up with a couple of stars on that stage on Sunday.
It's going to be a great show, I think, because the Boston Pops is one of the greatest orchestras in the world of any kind of music, and that they can really play anything. And to collaborate with them again, especially at Tanglewood, is going to be, for me, like a celebration. The program will be an amalgam of great American standards plus a couple of newer things thrown in for variety. And the show is going to have a great celebratory nature because of the collaboration with Christine Eberson and Betty Buckley, two extraordinary talents and great people. And we have a lot of fun on stage. So I think more than anything, it'll be energizing for the audience and certainly a perfect experience to have under the stars.
Again, that's Michael Feinstein joining with the Boston Pops and Christine Ebersole and Betty Buckley. That's coming up Sunday, September 2nd at Tanglewood in Lenox, Mass. Michael Feinstein, I just want to thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show, and congratulations on your new appointment in Pasadena, and I'm sure we'll catch up with you soon.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck if you've ever been a lady to begin with. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort. It isn't fair. It isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. Let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady tonight. Got my tweed pressed, got my best. All I need now is the girl. Got my striped tie, got my hopes high, got the time and the place that I got rhythm. Now all I need's the girl to go with him. If she'll just appear, we'll take this big town for a whirl. And if she'll say, my darling, I'm yours, I'll throw away my striped tie and my best dress tweed. All I really need is the girl. Luck be a
the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you're carrying with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady.
Listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.